Hello and welcome to the Vet Blast podcast. I am your host, Dr. Adam Christman, Chief Veterinary Officer here at Fetch DVM 360.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Vet Blast podcast, Feline Diabetes Awareness Month, and we want to thank our friends at Boehringer Ingelheim for supporting this great conversation all month long, and I hope you're pulling over to the side of the road because I'm just honored to be in her presence as we chat with Dr. Audrey Cook in the house. How are you, Doc?
I am great, Adam. Thank you for that very positive introduction. That's made my day.
Well, let me tell you, you have done incredible work and continue to do incredible work in our profession. And on behalf of all of us in veterinary medicine, seriously, thank you for all the great work you do.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I am so privileged to be a vet. I wanted to be a vet since I was six. I'm still living my dream.
I love
and
that.
I'm way beyond the age of six.
I love it. It's such a calling from within too. And I think I was six or seven too. And I love hearing that because it's like we hear that calling and we're living it every day. And I just love that. So to our friends, a little bit more information about Dr. Cook. She's a graduate of the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. She completed her internship at NC State and her residency in small animal internal medicine at UC Davis. Dr. Cook is a diplomat of both the American and European College of Veterinary Internal Medicine and is also recognized as a specialist in feline practice by the American Board of Veterinary Practitioners. After a decade in private referral practice, Dr. Cook joined the faculty at Texas A&M. She's now professor of small animal internal medicine with particular interest in endocrinology, gastroenterology, and interventional radiology. So many great specialties and great fields out there. It's just great time to be a vet. And as we're talking to the listeners, I want to keep in mind, think about the technology that has changed and science as it's advancing, because we're going to be chatting about feline diabetes. And my goodness, Dr. Cook, it's so interesting right now. And I guess I'll start by asking, like, what interests you about feline diabetes?
I've always thought the feline diabetes is fascinating because it's so different to canine. And whenever I teach the students, I always say, kind of close your note folder on doggy diabetes and have a brand new piece of paper for feline diabetes. And I think it's interesting because it's often a really good model for human type 2 diabetes. And we're always interested in things that might impact our own health. And so when I think about a cat becoming a diabetic, without a doubt, some of them have some strong genetic tendencies. And so it's almost like the cards that you're dealt at birth may set you up to become a diabetic. And then if you're unlucky and you're a bit of a sedentary, indoor, portly cat, and maybe you're not on a particularly well thought out food, you're picking up more cards that go into your hand. And then you hit a tipping point where you become potentially a diabetic. One of the things that's very analogous to what happens in type 2 diabetes in people are these two really important concepts of insulin resistance and glucose toxicity, because they do seem to be really important drivers in a cat actually getting all of the cards he needs to become a diabetic.
Yeah, let's unpack that a little bit more, because, you know, insulin resistance, we hear that a lot. So as we hear that phrase, what does that really mean when we hear about insulin resistance?
So insulin resistance is a sign that your body doesn't respond as well to insulin. And so it simply takes more insulin to get the job done. And lots of things can cause insulin resistance. We do know that simply being overweight is going to do it. And chronic inflammatory conditions like gingivitis cause insulin resistance. If you're on glucocorticoids because of your skin disease, that's going to impact how well your tissues, particularly muscle and fat, respond to insulin. And so step one, if the body doesn't respond well to insulin, is for the pancreas to make more to keep blood glucose under control. And there's a price to be paid for that, because each time you're secreting insulin, you're co-secreting this molecule called amylin or amyloid peptide. And that in people and in cats kind of is a bit gluey, and basically it gets stuck in the pancreas. So the more insulin you're putting out and the more amylin you're putting out, the more amyloid becomes deposited in that pancreas, and the more unpleasant the environment becomes for the beta cells. It becomes like a self-fulfilling event. It spirals forward where you end up getting amyloidosis in the pancreas, and we think that that really impacts beta cell health. Probably very simplistic, but that's a relatively easy way of thinking about what happens when you're insulin resistant.
And then, so we have the insulin resistance, and we often talk about glucose toxicity. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. So when I first heard the term glucose toxicity, my brain went to, patients with a blood sugar of 500 or 600. Well, I'm sure that's not good for you. It makes sense that it's toxic. But actually, we know from human studies that glucose toxicity starts when the blood glucose has gone over just 200 milligrams per deciliter. So not a shockingly high glucose at all. And every cell in the body is potentially vulnerable to glucose toxicity. And exactly what happens is still very poorly understood. There's some really interesting theories about damage to mitochondria and compromise to how the cell is able to generate its energy. But basically, nothing is working well when blood sugar is over 200 in people. It's probably very similar in cats. And ironically, the cells that are particularly vulnerable to glucose toxicity are the beta cells of the pancreas. And so when blood sugar gets over 200, and at that point, remember, a cat isn't spilling glucose into its urine. It's not even overtly a diabetic. Nobody would have any idea the blood glucose was, say, 220. But when the beta cells are sitting in that mildly hyperglycemic world, some of them actually die. Some of them shut down and think, I am not going to bother to make insulin because it is just too much work and I'm not getting anywhere. But some of those cells die. And in experimental studies, if you take perfectly healthy young cats with robust pancreases and you clamp them, meaning you force their glucose to stay about 400 for 10 days, and then you rebiopsy their pancreases, they've lost half of their beta cells. So glucose toxicity happens fairly quickly, and it's pretty darn dramatic. And so we have this scenario where a cat is insulin resistant. The pancreas is working harder, the pancreas is starting to struggle, the blood glucose is sitting at 220, and then we're actually starting to lose beta cells. And then we hit a tipping point where there's not enough functioning beta cells to keep blood glucose below the renal threshold, and the cat is now overtly diabetic and presents to the veterinarian.
And this is different to dogs, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably a bit simplistic to say cats are type 2 and dogs are type 1, but certainly in dogs, we tend to think that immune attack upon the beta cells plays a much more important role, along with genetic markers. And there's this idea now about overall pancreatic resilience, but I do think generally a dog can be regarded as a type 1 and a cat can be regarded as a type 2. And that explains why we just presume that every dog has got irreversible diabetes mellitus, unless it was that rare diastrous diabetic. Whereas in cats, if we can shift some of this underlying bad pathology, we can reverse the insulin resistance and reverse the effects of glucose toxicity. That's why some cats will go into diabetic remission, meaning they can maintain euglycemia without medical help, which dogs will not do.
Interesting. Okay, so let's, go over the clinical signs a little bit. So walk us through how a cat with DM is likely to present to us, the veterinarian.
So if I were to sketch out the poster child of the cat diabetic, the one that comes to my mind is a BCS about 7 out of 9, about a 7-year-old castrated male. His life is spent going from food bowl that contains dry, high carbohydrate kibbies to the sofa, and then maybe a little bit of bird watching through the window, and then back to the food bowl, and then back to the sofa. And then maybe he gets a little bit of more dental disease or something else that again just makes that insulin resistance more effective. Or maybe he's put on a short course of steroids for some dermatopathy. No matter what, we end up with the patient who had all these risk factors for becoming a diabetic and then kind of crosses that threshold and starts to spill glucose. And so the owners are going to notice increase in thirst, increase in urination, and usually hunger. So this is a cat that's tapping you on the cheek at 4 a.m. saying, I think it's time for breakfast. But anybody can become a diabetic. So I would never say that you are too skinny or too young or too old. But if I had the poster child, it would be the overweight, sedentary, middle-aged male cat. Sometimes the cats will present because of signs directly attributable to glucose toxicity. And in cats, what people can see is that neuropathy, that peripheral neuropathy, where you have a cat that has a plantigrade stance and can't jump up onto the furniture. So I've had a few scenarios where that is why the cat presented for can't jump. You look at this cat and think, you have been hyperglycemic for weeks or months, and you are absolutely a diabetic. It's just the other signs of diabetes, I guess, didn't catch the owner's attention so much. And then occasionally, if we're unlucky, we get a cat who presents with diabetic ketoacidosis. So that would be a a patient that comes in the clinic and they're not eating, maybe they're vomiting, they're dehydrated, they're depressed, they're clinically ill from DKA. But that's not a very common way for diabetic cats to present, fortunately.
Right. Okay, so we have the clinical signs, and as far as establishing the diagnosis, walk us through that process.
So diabetics are going to be hyperglycemic and glycosuric. Now, if you've got a canine patient, tick the box, you've made the diagnosis. In cats, it's a bit more complicated because cats have this phenomenon of stress hyperglycemia. So if the visit to the vet was miserable, starting with your mom chasing you around the house carrying the cat carrier and then using the water bottle to get you out from under the bed, the cat can spike a high blood glucose. If the blood glucose goes over 300, you're going to get glucose in the urine. So in your clinic, you might get a cat who has a blood sugar of 320, and yes, it has glucose in its urine, but that's just the stress effect. So whenever we're trying to make that diagnosis in a cat, we need what I always call corroborative evidence. And so that would include good clinical signs. So if the cat presents for polyuria, polydipsia, polyphagia, he's hyperglycemic and glycosuric, feel pretty good that he's a diabetic. If you find ketones in the urine or get higher ketones in the blood, that's also excellent corroborative evidence that you have a diabetic. In patients where we're not sure, it's kind of gray zone, we can certainly measure a fructosamine, and that will give us an average blood glucose over the previous 7 to 10 days. Or we can send the cat home, let him chill, let him relax, and then see if the owner can maybe collect a urine sample in a couple of days and see if there's glucose in that urine sample. And that would prove, okay, in the home environment, this cat is spilling glucose, this cat is a diabetic. So you do have to be a bit more thoughtful calling that diagnosis in cats than we can be in dogs.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so this is the exciting part, which I love about veterinary medicine. So once we have the confirmed diagnosis of diabetes, we have some treatment choices that are out there. So tell the listeners about this.
Yes, we do. And so for most of my career and more decades than I care to count, it was insulin. We would have this slightly stressful, long, complicated conversation with an owner about starting their cat on insulin therapy, with all of the caveats about you mustn't miss a dose. But if the cat's responding differently to the insulin than we expect, of course, you could kill him with the hypoglycemia. So bear that in mind. And if he is hypoglycemic, do the following. And it was never an easy conversation to talk about insulin. And for many owners, it's a stopping point. If you look at the statistics on survivability for diabetic cats, they're worse than cats diagnosed with small cell bowel lymphoma. And that's because a lot of owners would hear the story of insulin and maybe they would bravely try it, but it was difficult with lifestyle and commitments, and they can't travel, and the hypoglycemia, it just was a lot to put on an owner. But miracle of miracles, we now have oral hypoglycemic agents. So you don't have to have that discussion about, you see that tiny mark on this syringe? That is the insulin dose. None of that needs to happen. And so I am so excited that I have not retired before these drugs came out, because I would have been very frustrated to have missed out on this. And so now we have the SGLT2 inhibitors, and this is a huge drug class in human diabetic care. I think right now there's about 10 drugs in this class that are licensed throughout the world. They've been around for more than a decade. The last time I did a Google Scholar search on the SGLT2 inhibitors, I got 47,000 scholarly articles. And so there is a vast amount of understanding on how these really clever drugs work. And they basically are the first oral hypoglycemic to work consistently in cats. There's two. There is velagliflozin, which is Synvelgo, and that's made by BI. And then there is bexagliflozin, which is Bexacat, and that's a tablet, and that's made by Elanco. The Synvelgo made by BI is velagliflozin oral solution, so that's a liquid. So this is given once daily by mouth. With the oral liquid, it's very easy. You can just it's a small volume, just drop it onto a little bit of wet food. I actually tested my own non-diabetic cat for palatability with the Synvelgo, because she won't take anything by mouth, and she did take the Synvelgo. Oh, so wow. It truly is a, whenever people say this is a palatable feline product, I always lift an eyebrow and say, uh-huh, really? But the Synvelgo, if my cat will take Synvelgo, anybody's cat will take Synvelgo. The nice thing about it is a lot of the concerns with the insulin, with the timing and the accuracy, a push to one side. So once a day, if you're an hour or two earlier or later, it's not a problem. the drug is so safe as far as essentially zero risk of clinical hypoglycemia that yes, I gave it to my own euglycemic cat without a concern. If dad gives a dose to the diabetic cat and then mom gives a dose, it's perfectly fine. If the non-diabetic cat in the family scarfs the food that's got the SGLT2 inhibitor in it, that cat is perfectly fine. And so the safety profile for this drug is stunning. I mean, it is just night and day compared to insulin. And then efficacy is amazing. An awful lot of cats, something like 50% of cats, are euglycemic within a week. And we don't say that about cats that we've just started on insulin therapy. So, an incredibly exciting drug class, really a game changer.
It really is a game changer. And are the SGLT2 inhibitors suitable for all diabetic cats?
They're not, because the SGLT2 inhibitors require that you are still able to make a little bit of insulin. Obviously, you're not making enough insulin to keep your blood glucose under control. But what we know is it just takes, I always say, it takes a pinch of insulin to stop ketosis. So it takes a teaspoonful of insulin to keep blood glucose under control and just a pinch of insulin to prevent ketosis. And most diabetic cats walking into the doctor's office, we expect to still be able to make just enough insulin to prevent ketosis. So you do need that low-grade background insulin production. If we have a cat where we're suspicious that they don't have enough background insulin production, and those are cats who would present ketotic, and we'll talk specifically about that because it's so important, those cats are not candidates for an SGLT2 inhibitor. Other times when I would say, oh, it's not a good candidate, would be a cat who's got a significant comorbidity. So CKD stage, high stage two or stage three, a cat with untreated hyperthyroidism. And certainly, if a cat is not happy and cheerful and hydrated and eating, that cat is not a candidate for an SGLT2. So it really is a very stable, cheerful, hydrated, new diabetic cat with basically nothing else wrong with them and without evidence of ketosis.
Okay, so physical exam, history, CBC chem, UA, total T4, those kinds of things, and ketone measurement. So that sounds really interesting. Let's talk a little bit more about the ketone measurement because I think this might be newer to us in veterinary medicine. So tell us a bit more about measuring them.
Yes. So traditionally, we would only talk about ketones from the perspective of what we saw when we did a urine dipstick test. And so we would absolutely check if we saw any sick diabetic, we would do a urine dipstick test and say, oh, yes, there's, do you think it's one plus? Do you think it's two? I mean, that's very,
Right.
very, very, very amateur efforts of assessing ketone levels. And so we've not had to worry about it because if you're treating a patient with insulin, it doesn't really matter what their ketone levels are. You're going to give them insulin, and that is the antidote to ketosis. But when we're thinking about cats who are on SGLT2 inhibitors, ketosis now is one of the things that we really have to think very specifically about because, again, we need cats to have just that little bit, that little pinch of background insulin production. So when we first see the cat, we need to make sure that it's not ketotic. And we now know there's been lots of work historically that's compared measuring blood beta-hydroxybutyrate, which is the number one ketone. So that's really what matters. There's been some nice studies that have compared measuring the blood BHB to doing that dipstick. And the dipstick is picking up mostly acetoacetate. Some dipsticks pick up acetate as well. But that's not an important ketone in the cat. And so the urine is, it's not even a glimpse of what's really happening. It was good enough for us. It didn't really matter. But it's
Right.
not a good enough glimpse now. And what we really need to do is just simply measure blood BHB. And whenever I talk to vets and say, you really just need to get a ketone meter, people are like, another piece of machine to sit on the counter. No, they're like portable blood glucose machines. You can buy them on Amazon for $60, and they're very similar technology. It looks just like a glucometer, and some of them will actually measure glucose and blood BHB. And so very, very simple, very, very inexpensive. If you buy a machine and use it in two patients, you're in the money. And once you have one, it's amazing how often you'll be saying, let's just check a ketone. And certainly if you're going to be using an SGLT2 inhibitor, I think it's something that you need to buy. If you haven't got a machine and you're kind of in a crisis, rather than doing the urine on the dipstick, the best thing to do actually is to just put blood plasma on the urine dipstick. That is actually going to be more sensitive for picking up significant ketosis. So the blood plasma on the pee stick will flag you there's a concern way before the urine on the pea stick would. But still, best off, just buy a machine and then you've got an absolute number. It is a little bit confusing because there's different ways that the amounts are expressed. And I always talk in terms of BHB in millimoles per liter because that's what the handheld units will demonstrate. And so that's the number that most of us need to really understand. So a perfectly healthy cat, like a basically undetectable, like usually less than 0.1. A happy diabetic on insulin, usually less than one. Most of your walking in the door untreated naive diabetics are still usually less than one. Sometimes they're a little bit higher. And I would tend to say, ooh, we need to think about insulin if that BHB is over 2.4, and certainly if that BHB is over 3.6. Now, I'm sharing some pretty conservative numbers with you. Some folks have been much bolder about still reaching for an SGLT2 inhibitor, even if that blood BHB is over 3.6. I would advise caution because that tells you that this cat is making a lot of ketones, and walking in the door, that cat is not making enough insulin to limit ketosis. I think it's much safer to start those cats on insulin. Once they're on the SGLT2 inhibitor, we're not really worried to start with about what it does for their blood glucose, although if you check it, you are often utterly amazed about how fast that blood glucose comes back in the reference range. What we really care about in the first 2 weeks in particular is what's happening to that blood BHB, because that's going to tell us about insulin production, which is disconnected from blood glucose when you're on an SGLT2. So the SGLT2 will get your blood glucose to 90.
Okay.
But we need your pancreas to be making just enough insulin to stop ketosis. And so we do talk about very carefully monitoring BHB for those first 2 weeks, because that's when you kind of figure out, is your pancreas able to do what it needs to do or not? Most of the cats where the pancreas is not up to snuff are going to declare themselves in those first 2 weeks, and they're going to declare themselves by that blood BHB just moving up and up and up. And so when they're on treatment, I want that BHB to stay below 2.4 millimoles per liter. If you're getting a number below one, you're sweet. If you're between one and 2.4, you get them back in a couple of days and recheck. So we do have some pretty good guidelines about checking BHBs before you start the meds, day two or day three, day seven, and day 14. But any time in between there, on those first 2 weeks, that you have any concerns or that number is drifting in the wrong direction, you should get that cat back in say 24 to 48 hours and recheck that BHB.
Okay, excellent. So great outline recommendation for monitoring. What about, needing insulin if the cat's losing weight, if blood sugars are high? What are some other recommendations for monitoring?
Yeah, so great. So for me, the first 2 weeks is all about BHB. Not that fussed about blood glucose. Don't care if your blood sugar is still 400. I'm only going to care about your BHB in the first couple of weeks. I would say at day 30, that is the time to take a step back and say, okay, how well am I doing as far as controlling all the clinical signs of diabetes and controlling the hyperglycemia? So first couple of weeks, we don't worry about blood glucose, ketones, ketones. Day 30, I would absolutely check ketones each and every time I lay my hands on these cats. But that's when I'm going to say, where are we at with our blood glucose? If the spot check blood glucose at day 30 is 110, the drug is working. You have achieved euglycemia. Package inserts do talk about redoing glucose curves, but in all honesty, it's not a curve. You check a blood glucose in these cats and it's 97, 99, 110, 105. There is no curve. It's a straight line. If your spot check is high, again, have you scared the cat? Because the cat could get a stress hyperglycemia. So if at day 30 blood sugar is out of the reference range, I would look carefully at the cat's clinical signs. Is the weight where you want it to be? Does the owner report less polyuria, polydipsia, polyphagia? I would also measure a fructosamine because, again, that's going to give us a nice look at what blood glucose has been doing the previous 7 to 10 days. Often these cats are back in the normal range on fructosamine, not the well done diabetic reference range, but the healthy, normal, non-diabetic cat reference range because their blood glucoses are so effectively controlled with this drug. We certainly by day 30 expect that cat's fructosamine to have dropped by at least 50 points. If though it's day 30 and the cat is still clinical for diabetes, the blood sugar is still high, the fructosamine really hasn't budged. Even if the cat's mum's like, I think he's doing okay, I would say he's still very diabetic. And that would be a time that I would say we're going to have to put to one side the lovely, easy, low stress SGLT2 inhibitor and have that long and complicated conversation about insulin. So day 30 is really my point for saying, am I addressing the diabetes effectively? Yes or no? And in most cats that are appropriately selected, it's going to be a robust yes. But the drug's not going to work for everybody. There are some cats where it just doesn't seem to be able to lower blood glucose as much as we need.
Okay, excellent. Fantastic conversation, my friend. I just was, as you were talking, I was thinking, my gosh, even 5-10 years ago, you know, we just would automatically put them on insulin, you know, we give the diagnosis. And now when we're talking about individualized care, precision medicine, we have these options that are out here now, which is phenomenal. I want to share this one story with you, get your take on this. I had a client, she's like, Dr. Chris, I know she's diabetic. I could just tell, like, she's, you know, sure enough, she was. And she's like, I don't want to do insulin. I heard about oral options. I'm loving that clients are reading up on this and knowing about the options that are out there. What are your thoughts on that, being that you've been in this field for some time? So it's nice to see what clients' perspectives are.
Well, I think it's so exciting with the whole information explosion. I think it's wonderful that clients are able to get access to information because, I mean, when I was a youngster, we were the expert in the room. And now I tell my students, if you've got a client who's got access to high-speed internet and a lunch break, they may know more about their pet's condition than you do. And so you have got to keep up and you've got to be very respectful for the questions that clients bring to you. Sometimes they bring you great ideas. Sometimes they're a little bit crazy, but sometimes they're really on the mark. And so I love that clients, I mean, for a client's perspective, this, it's revolutionary. I have always dreaded one of my own cats becoming a diabetic, and I feel embarrassed to admit that, but it's on my list of dreads. Yes. Because I don't live a life where it's going to be easy to manage a diabetic cat. I travel, and my husband could never pull up 2 units of insulin in a syringe. It's just not going to happen. And so I think for so many people, this has just been, the sun has come up on feline diabetes. And when I talk to vets about feline diabetes, often it's one of the diseases that they dislike the most because they find the cases frustrating and disappointing. And very quickly, the clients are frustrated and disappointed. And so the whole interaction becomes something that's not positive. Now I feel vets can open their cupboard and say, I have something, really good chance it's going to work in your cat, and it's not going to change your life. It's not going to make things difficult for you. It's going to be 100 times easier than it used to be. And so I do think it's wonderful. This is one of the most exciting things to happen in veterinary medicine. I would say, well, the FIP stuff, that is equally, pop the champagne. So the FIP stuff and then feline diabetes, these are diseases that we have taken from being bad news to we have options. And this is a completely different conversation. It's a brand new day.
Yes. And keeping these cats with their owners, you know, because I don't know if the listeners, I'm sure you can all relate to, sometimes some of these cats unfortunately get relinquished up to shelters or rescue groups. And this is such a great opportunity now where we could say, no, we have great options and life's going to be great. We're going to be fine. And so it's just so exciting to have these options that are out there. Wonderful information. Thank you so much, Dr. Audrey Cook, for joining us here on the Vet Blast podcast. Such an honor, literally sharing the screen with you. I'm kind of fangirling out. I'm loving it.
Well, it is fun. I always love to talk to you, and I'd love to talk to anybody. I could stop strangers in the street and talk about feline diabetes.
That might be our new show. That's what I think we have to do.
That would be a hoot, wouldn't it?
I love it. Thank you to our friends at Boehringer Ingelheim again for supporting this wonderful conversation. And it's Feline Diabetes Awareness Month, so always keep that top of mind. And don't forget to rate the podcast as we continue to grow. And we'll see you next time right here on the Vet Blast podcast. Take care, everyone. Thank you for listening to the Vet Blast podcast with me, Dr. Adam Christman. Tune in next time. Remember, take care of your animals and always stay pawsome. Important safety information. Synvelgo oral solution is indicated to improve glycemic control in otherwise healthy cats with diabetes mellitus not previously treated with insulin. Before using this product, it is important to read the entire product insert, including the box warning. Cats treated with Synvelgo may be at increased risk of diabetic ketoacidosis or euglycemic diabetic ketoacidosis, both of which may result in death. Development of these conditions should be treated promptly
including insulin administration and discontinuation of Synvelgo. Do not use Synvelgo in cats with diabetes mellitus who have previously been treated with insulin, who are receiving insulin, or in cats with insulin-dependent diabetes mellitus. The use of Synvelgo in cats with insulin-dependent diabetes mellitus or the withdrawal of insulin and initiation of Synvelgo is associated with an increased risk of diabetic ketoacidosis or euglycemic diabetic ketoacidosis and death. Sudden onset of hyporexia, anorexia, lethargy, dehydration, or weight loss in cats receiving Synvelgo should prompt immediate discontinuation of Synvelgo and assessment for diabetic ketoacidosis, regardless of blood sugar level. Synvelgo should not be initiated in cats with ketonuria, ketonemia, pancreatitis, anorexia, dehydration, or lethargy at the time of diagnosis or diabetes mellitus, as it may indicate the presence of other concurrent disease and increase the risk of diabetic ketoacidosis. Keep Synvelgo in a secure location out of reach of children, dogs, cats, and other animals to avoid accidental ingestion or overdose. For more information, please refer to the enclosed package insert or visit SynvelgoClinic.com.